You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on our summer music series Setlist, we'll hear from the Davenport, Iowa band, The Multiple Cat.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup.
Governor Walker endorsed Donald Trump this week and said he'll be speaking at the upcoming Republican National Convention in Cleveland.
Also this week, Ron Johnson, senator from Wisconsin, submitted an amendment that would create an exception for voucher schools. And we learned a certain brand of Wisconsin soda is making a comeback.
Robert Menser joins us now to give us the latest on those stories. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks.
So starting with Governor Scott Walker, he has not been the best of friends with Donald Trump, but he has, I guess, thrown his support behind Donald Trump this week. Maybe not a full-throated way, but what happened this week, Rob?
Yes, Governor Scott Walker gave Donald Trump sort of an all-time great lukewarm endorsement. He tweeted, his tweet was, "Last August, I said I'd support the GOP nominee. It's now clear who the RNC delegates will vote to nominate, and he is better than she is." So, yeah, I mean, you can, I think I know who he's talking about there. I'm pretty sure that's Trump and Hillary Clinton. So that's I will count it as an endorsement, but it's not real enthusiastic.
Did he run out of characters on Twitter?
I mean, yeah, well, this is a fair point. This is a fair point. The medium itself has some constraints. And you know what? I mean, this has been Walker's stance basically since the end of the Republican primary. He's never been or really signaled that he was a never Trump guy. He always has said that he would support the Republican nominee over the Democratic nominee. So the news is this is more explicit than he has been. And for sure, the fact that he is choosing to speak the Republican National Convention, which not every, not all of his fellow one-time candidates are, is a sign that he's on the Trump train. I think that we can sort of deduce from his statements that speech is likely to be heavy on attacks on Hillary Clinton and maybe a little light on kind of substantive positive support for Trump. But who knows? Maybe we'll see.
So you don't think he necessarily has to amp up his support for Trump if he's speaking?
I mean, I guess the thing is, like, it's going to be under a microscope now, right? Everyone's speeches will be, they'll be analyzed by the political junkies for are they trying to keep a little distance between themselves and Trump. But the other thing that we know from sort of political science that is that one of the major motivating factors for voters in America today is what is called negative partisanship, which is you're not voting for the guy or woman who you particularly like, you're voting against the other party. And so, maybe there's probably going to be a lot of that going around at both conventions.
And sticking with presidential politics for a bit, Donald Trump met with Congress this week, members of Congress, Republicans in the House and the Senate. So what did we hear about how those meetings went? Any updates from Wisconsinites like Paul Ryan, Reed Ribble, and Sean Duffy?
Yeah, it was it's like the blind men describing the elephant, right? Sean Duffy, who is a House member who supports Trump, came out, said he thought it was a great meeting. Everything went great. They're building trust. Representative Reed Ribble from over the Green Bay area, who is retiring from Congress this year. He's not seeking reelection, and he is pointedly not a Trump supporter. He came out and said he didn't think the meeting moved the needle at all, and he hadn't changed his mind. Paul Ryan, of course, House Speaker, said that it was a good first step. Everybody is starting to get along. So I think it's who you how you saw that meeting depends on where you sit on this question of is Trump an acceptable candidate.
It's our state news roundup, and we're catching up with Rob Menser, storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. And also in state news, Senator Ron Johnson introduced an amendment that would block the Department of Justice from enforcing parts of the Americans with Disabilities Act for voucher schools. Tell us about that one.
Yes, and Senator Johnson's point of view would be that it clarifies the current law, but I guess this is part of the problem. So this is all inspired by an investigation that was opened by the Department of Justice into a voucher school in Milwaukee. That investigation was closed, and there are no charges brought against this school. But the way it came about was that school had been subject to a lawsuit by the ACLU that said that they were not complying with Americans with Disabilities Act rules. And so Johnson's amendment, which is sort of, he attached it to a federal appropriations bill. That bill hasn't passed, but it's sort of a slightly weird. He's stuck on this policy thing. The idea would be that it would prevent the DOJ from doing such an investigation or from looking into those types of issues with schools that receive vouchers.
And what have we heard from critics of that amendment so far?
Well, so the substantive issue really is interesting. So the law requires that public schools provide free, appropriate public education to all students, including those with disabilities. And that is sort of, that's our consistent with our sense of what a public school ought to do. It means a lot of things. It means that school buildings should be accessible to somebody who uses a wheelchair, but it also means all kinds of things about giving accommodations for children who have learning disabilities or who are on the autism spectrum or you know, whatever it may be. They do get some other sorts of federal funding to provide those special education services, but that takes a lot of money and effort for public schools to provide those that type of education. And private schools are private; they don't have to do any of that. The argument here is that if you're a private school, then okay, you're a private enterprise; you follow the rules you want. But once they accept public money, taxpayer money in the form of school vouchers, then they should become open to the same sorts of educational requirements when it comes to students with disabilities. So, that's an argument that's used typically by people who are opposed to school vouchers in the first place. But it's sort of, there's a certain appeal to it. It makes sense, right? In general, you would hope that schools would be open and would be providing, accommodations to special education students as needed.
And we're going to wrap up, Rob, talking about a surprising comeback in the world of Wisconsin soda. I remember the name Jolly Good. Is it something you remember, or are you too young?
Yeah, no, I've never heard of this. Well,
I have to
admit the shameful truth that I grew up in Central Illinois.
Ah, gotcha.
So that's probably why I missed it. But yeah, this was I want to say this is the biggest non-horrible story of this week. People are really, really excited about the return of Jolly Good Soda. This was it sort of started in the 70s. I think it peaked in the 80s and into the 90s. In Wisconsin, and the news that USA Today Network Wisconsin reported out of Sheboygan this week is that it's going to make a comeback. It had it was known at its heyday for like a bunch of crazy flavors, and they're bringing it back with cherry flavor and grape, some of these different fruit flavored type sodas. Not to my taste, but I guess some people this is what they want out of their soda. And the owner has produced a test run of 22,000 cases of it using original recipes, and it's being sold right like in the area around the craft plant in Random Lake, and they're talking seriously about taking it statewide or making it something you can order online or taking it all over the nation. People are excited.
For now, limited distribution. You got to head up to certain areas to get it. Well, Rob, thanks a lot for joining us this week.
All right. Thank you.
That was news editor Rob Menser. He joins us every week at this time for our Wisconsin News Roundup.
And I'll just tell Rob that I'm from Chicago and I know all about Jolly Good Soda, so maybe it is a generational thing.
We continue our summer music series, Setlist. We invited artists from all over the Midwest into the WPR studios for interviews and exclusive musical performances, which air every Friday at this time until Labor Day weekend.
Today, we featured the Iowa band The Multiple Cat, who recently stopped by our studio to play some songs from their latest album, Intricate Maps, and talk with Rob Ferret about the evolution of the band's ever-changing cast of musicians. ¶¶
Multiple Cat, thanks a lot for joining us up here in the studio.
Thanks for having us.
It's our pleasure.
Well, Pat, let's start with you. The band's been around for quite a while now. How did it get started?
It got started just because I was screwing around with some recording stuff in a friend of mine's mom's basement, really. We're just jamming, and at a certain point, we realized I had a bunch of songs and called it something, so I called it The Multiple Cat.
And why did you call it The Multiple Cat?
This is a favorite question of everyone's. Well, that same guy was working at a grocery store, and he was stocking shelves. We were, you know, young, 22, 3 years old, something. And he was stocking the multiple cat formula cat litter, and he just kept talking about how stupid it was that it would make any difference for one cat or 10 cats or any number of cats. It's the same stuff. That's the absurdity of marketing and the absurdity of ideas like that is what kind of what the name came from, not so much the litter itself.
And looking you guys up online gives a really interesting mix of hits. It's half you and half, you know, getting cats to enjoy sharing their litter box.
Yeah, I think we're really missing a boat on marketing, actually.
Really?
I called you a band, and Ben, let's get you in on this. A band, I've heard collective as a word thrown around. The borders are permeable.
It's Pat's creation. It's his creativity. It's his songs. And I've been around for 4 years, but there's been a cat. Pretty much everybody back home that's worth a darn musically has been through the group at some point. So this is the current incarnation, but it's been many things.
But as I understand it, this new album, Intricate Maps, was recorded more like as a band than previous ones. How did that work out?
It was great. Andrew actually didn't play on the record, although he engineered some of the recording. It was really different. I mean, we wrote the songs together and, you know, wrote our parts. For the most part, there was a couple songs that I did by myself, more or less. But it was different than just having an idea and just building on it. You know, it was back and forth, and things, you know, changed from the time I brought them. Because all the songs are still mine, but I brought them to the guys, and we'd go, you know, it's the kind of stuff that all kinds of bands do all the time, but I don't that much.
And Ben, what is it like translating from the recording for an album like this to live shows?
One thing that I hear from people live is that we do a three-piece, and we seem to pull off the three-piece well as far as sonically. The album's got synthesizers. It's got all kinds of... Pat's an audio guy. He's an engineer, and they use that as a process part of the art. Well, live, you have to kind of reinterpret that live in a way that's captivating to people. And you do that through effects, and you do that through pauses and refrains and songs and putting stuff differently than you would on the album where there's other instruments.
And Andrew, he was saying you joined after the album was recorded. So what was it like making the drum part of this come to life for the live shows?
It was interesting to kind of learn Pat's songs having been interpreted by Phil and then interpreting his parts that he was, you know, creating, kind of making them my own and bringing the correct part but the sort of a different flavor to it.
Well, and he was our drummer and then got a chance to go to Japan for a while. And while he was gone, Phil was filling in, and then Phil just kind of like became our drummer. So he came back from Japan and we said, well, we have Phil. So
yeah, to have a drum off, presumably.
Yeah. And then Phil said, I'm too busy. Can Andrew take back over for me? So then Andrew became the drummer again. So it was kind of funny how it happened.
Right. And now I'm in a position where I'm getting sort of busy and we're sort of both doing it.
And now
we're
he's sort of passed the baton back to Phil.
Right.
So. And that's why this whole band thing is kind of a fluid concept for you, it sounds like. And it works out because there's always somebody.
It is fluid, yeah.
You two have both mentioned you're audio engineers as well as musicians. How does one inform the other? How does that go playing back and forth between being the sound person and the musician person?
Well, I don't know. I feel like I was a musician first and foremost before I was an engineer. I always felt like that gave me an upper hand from an engineering perspective, especially when doing live sound reinforcement, just sort of understanding what it's like to be on stage, not just as an engineer. as an engineer, there are certain variables that you like to kind of keep under control or try to make as perfect as possible, and a lot of times it's not an option live. So I guess being able to comprehend that has helped. Conversely, being an engineer has made me be a lot more aware of what a song is and what a songwriting process is. It's been a co-informative kind of experience.
I would say all the stuff he said.
Yeah.
I did, in the beginning of Day Trotter, I did all the sessions for the first couple of years, and I continued to do a bunch, and so I've done maybe 1,500 or so. And recording a lot of bands like that and watching what they do and how they arrange things and how they use their pedals and things like that, that I've definitely learned from other bands as an engineer what I liked, what I didn't like, what was working, what wasn't working, spaces and songs and things like that.
When you're playing a live show and somebody else is doing the sound for you, does your experience as a sound engineer make you really easy to work with for them, or a massive pain in the butt to work with
easy
for them because you have all your preconceptions?
I have absolute empathy for every sound person in the world, and I truly do want to make their life easy, even if it's difficult for me and it's not perfect. I think, you know what, this guy's doing his thing. I'm over there sometimes, I understand it.
And Pat, you mentioned Day Trotter, and I wanted to ask you about that a little bit. Tell us what it is for people who haven't heard of it before.
Well, it's a lot of things, but primarily it's a website where touring bands from all over the world really come through and record anywhere from 3 to 5 songs straight to 2-track, whether it's tape or a digital recorder. Recorded, I don't know, 5,300 sessions or something like that at this point, maybe even more than that.
And you've had some big name bands through there, the National,
oh, yeah.
Bon Iver, Annie DeFranco, Spoon. You mentioned learning from, you know, their setup and their sound. Do you feel like you grow as a musician being involved and hearing the big names come through like that?
Yes. Yeah, and all those people are really cool. Seems like when people are really established, they seem to be the coolest and most mellow. You think it might
so
be the opposite.
They're not divas coming through.
Right, yeah. It's very rare. It's some sort of like up-and-comer, on-fire, hot people seem to be difficult.
Well, I wanted to talk about what you two in particular do outside of the Multiple Cats, since it's a permeable boundary.
Well, you were talking about Day Trotter. Andrew is actually their the venue manager, so you should talk about that a little bit.
Starting in January, we started doing shows at our new venue, which is basically just the front room of the same facility that houses our new studio, which is in Davenport, Iowa. We made the move across the river from Rock Island. It's a 400-capacity venue. Got some great stuff coming up. We've had some great stuff. So, yeah, good things happening there. Really, that's essentially what I'm doing outside of this currently.
And Ben, what's your side?
Well, I work at a record shop. I do construction. I spin vinyl, so as that gets more popular, we get gigs all over town. So I usually, any night of the week, I might have 2 or 3 nights where I'm spinning records. I do a turntable night for the record shop that I work at. My parents have a reception hall. I host bands there.
It's called Ragged Records.
Yeah, the record shop's called Ragged Records. And
the owner of that shop actually
phenomenal.
Put out this last Multiple Cat record. Mm-hmm. It's got a label called Cartouche.
Yeah, so we keep busy. I mean, there's plenty to do.
And what's Quad Cities like as a music scene?
It's rich with talent. It just it's still kind of a building as far as an audience. I mean, with Day Trotter's help, with clubs like Roz Talks, Ribco, RME, there's different places.
It's cool.
There's
an
arcade bar that just opened up, so it's really fun.
There's a lot going on, really. I mean, it's pretty cool. But the problem that we have is that we're not really a part of Iowa or a part of Illinois. Mm-hmm. We're kind of our own thing. Plus, we're on the river, which anybody who grew up or lives on the river knows that, like, that the river's almost its own place, up and down, you know, any of the cities that are up and down. Mm-hmm. So you have to scream a lot louder.
Yeah.
We're sort of a working-class place. John Deere's headquartered there.
They heard us in Wisconsin, so hey, everybody.
Yeah.
Smears of air, born of the land and the light.
What's next? You've got this new album out. What's next for The Multiple Cat?
We recorded a couple songs recently, and I need to finish them at some point. I bought a couple record cutter lathes from the 1930s back in December, so I'm working on restoring them. My plan is to cut these two new songs of ours to these one-off lathe cut records and then just offer them on Bandcamp and maybe start doing some stuff like that, go back into being more of a studio rat.
This is a record-cutting lathe that they would use just shy of a century ago?
Yeah.
You can cut albums that we could listen to with modern technology?
Yeah, they're mono. They're going to be mono. Unless I can afford a stereo head or someone makes a stereo head that'll fit on these machines. I mean, I'm still working on restoring them right now. I mean, it's like two steps forward, one step back kind of thing, and I'm really, really busy doing all kinds of stuff. So.
Yeah, it seems like you are the kind of person who's probably always got a project or eight going musically one way or another.
Seems like it. Yeah, plus I have two young kids and one kid in college and a house and a building. I own the building with a friend of mine where my studio is, so there's always something happening.
All right, guys, thanks a lot for coming up and playing in the studio with us.
Thanks for having us.
Been a blast.
That was the Davenport, Iowa band, The Multiple Cat, speaking with our own Rob Ferret. Setlist Summer Music Series airs every Friday at this time through Labor Day weekend. Support for Setlist comes from Hyde Music. For more about the artists featured on Setlist, including songs and videos of their exclusive performances at our WPR studio, head over to WPR.org/setlist.
Coming up, we talk about a draft of a report from Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources on the impacts of fracking. We find out why an environmental group thinks the report doesn't go far enough. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Since the hydraulic fracturing boom started about two decades ago, Wisconsin has been highly involved in mining silica sand. The sand is used by the fracking industry, along with other chemicals, to extract oil and gas trapped in shale rock.
The DNR released a draft of a comprehensive analysis on sand mining this week, but some environmental groups say the draft relies too much on data generated by the mining industry itself. Sarah Gears joins us now. She's the staff attorney at Midwestern Environmental Advocates, one of the groups voicing concern over the DNR's draft. And Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this is a new analysis. I gather it's a first draft from the DNR. What are your main complaints about it?
Well, first, I do want to start on a positive note by acknowledging our appreciation that the DNR agreed to do this analysis. Over 1,000 citizens signed a petition for a comprehensive study of the impacts of this industry, and DNR agreed to do that. So there are positive aspects to the review, but we are concerned that in some aspects, the DNR relies heavily on industry-funded data or draws conclusions that there aren't impacts where they just don't have the information to support that conclusion.
Does it reassure you that this is a draft, that there could be changes, that you could have input and influence the way it might come out in a final draft?
Absolutely. And that's why we're trying to spread the word to citizens to take a look at this, to provide comments to the DNR, both at the public hearing and in written comments before the August 22nd comment deadline, so that they can make their voices heard and make sure that the strategic analysis adequately assesses the potential impacts to their communities.
Now, can you tell us more, a little more specifically, what this analysis is supposed to look at?
Sure. It's pretty broad. For people who are familiar with environmental impact statements, it's sort of patterned after that. So the agency will look at all potential impacts to natural resources, public health, quality of life, et cetera, and assess whether, in this case, this particular industry will have negative or positive impacts. Specifically, some of my initial concerns were about the air quality section. The DNR has also done a good job acknowledging some unknowns about potential threats to groundwater and is doing further study, which we appreciate. But it really is wide-ranging.
So looking specifically at some of this data that you say came from the mining industry itself, where did that data come from and who conducted the research?
Sure. So the air quality section gets pretty technical pretty fast, but I'll try to boil it down. So several of the studies that the DNR relied on for its conclusion that crystalline silica, which is basically a particular type of emissions from these facilities, that information came from industry-funded studies that were voluntarily conducted at one or two facilities or facilities owned by one or two companies. Industry-funded data certainly has its place and provides valuable information, but we don't believe that it should be relied on so heavily in reaching a conclusion that this industry is not impacting air quality. You know, additionally, one of our main concerns is that the air quality section doesn't adequately address the potential threat from fine particulate matter, another type of air emission. And we've gone back and forth with DNR on that issue extensively.
Now, the data that you're talking about, is this the data that came from a nonprofit group called Institution for Wisconsin's Health?
The air quality data summarized in that document, the health impact assessment, is similar to the DNR's air quality analysis in the strategic analysis.
But is this the data that you're saying the DNR used when drawing its later conclusions in this analysis?
Correct.
Okay. And so is that institution, are they funded in general from with frac sand money, or was it just this particular study?
Yeah, to clarify, so the health impact assessment is similar to the strategic analysis in that it looks at existing data and draws conclusions about potential health impacts. So that assessment looked at the industry-funded studies, which were conducted at EOG Resources, that studied silica emissions from these facilities. DNR looked to those same studies. So we're not asserting that the health impact assessment was industry-funded, just that it has the same shortcomings as the strategic analysis.
Was there any alternative to that data?
In terms of crystalline silica, there is limited information, just as there is limited information about the impact of fine particulate or PM2.5 emissions from these facilities. So we're not saying that the DNR needs to affirmatively conclude that these facilities are emitting dangerous quantities of fine particulate matter, just that they need to acknowledge that that's an open question.
Right now, we are talking with Sarah Geer, staff attorney at Midwest Environmental Advocates, and talking about this recent analysis from the DNR, which some have said is too reliant on data from the mining industry. And Sarah, in your opinion, what do you think the DNR should do to compensate for this data, which you think may have a bias coming from funding from the mining industry? Where should they turn to get it?
Well, first and foremost, you know, as this is an analysis of the knowns and unknowns about the impacts of this industry, simply to acknowledge that there may not be enough information to reach a conclusion that there are not negative impacts to air quality from this industry. So we're just asking kind of to have the facts stated as they are. Additionally, because the DNR is in charge of regulating air quality, we would hope that the DNR would regulate these facilities in a way that would prevent potential impacts until they know that they're not a potential health threat, and additionally require monitoring to really figure that, to answer that question.
I want to move on and talk about the small particle emissions that you were talking about earlier. The report focuses on what's called PM10 emissions. First off, can you tell us what those are?
Yeah. So particulate matter is the general term for all types of particles in the air that are not otherwise made up of a specific chemical. As a subset of those include PM10, which is the larger of the fine particles. So particulate matter of 10 microns or less in diameter. PM2.5 is particulate matter that is 2.5 microns or less in diameter. So you can think of particulate matter as the biggest category, PM10 as a subset of that, and PM2.5 as a further subset of that.
And did the PM2.5 get addressed in this analysis?
Not adequately in our view. The DNR has looked to some studies that were primarily focused at looking at crystalline silica and has taken that data to say, along with other information the DNR has, there isn't a reason to be concerned about PM2.5. The DNR's position in the strategic analysis reflects a faulty premise that we've seen in other recent DNR regulatory actions. And so we've addressed this issue with them. We've raised concerns about the data that they're relying on, which, in addition to industry-funded studies, is simply summarized. It's just not enough information to support their conclusion. And EPA has echoed those concerns.
So taking it down to the level of people who might live near one of these frac sand mines, why should they care about PM2.5 emissions? What are the health consequences that you see?
So PM2.5 is acknowledged as one of the most dangerous types of fine particulate matter in the ambient air. Because the particles are very fine, they can get deep down in the lungs and into the bloodstream, causing serious respiratory and cardiovascular impacts. Now, that's not meant to scare people. You know, there's particulate matter everywhere in the air. So cause for concern arises when there are unsafe levels of this fine particulate matter in the air. And that's what we want to be sure the DNR is preventing until we know that these facilities aren't contributing to that.
And as far as the PM10 emissions, were they found to be, how were they described in terms of their possibility to harm in this report?
Well, the DNR basically gave the frac sand industry a clean bill of health in regard to air impacts and said of all the types of air pollutants, there's not a problem given the way we're currently regulating. So for PM10, the DNR does have a bit more information because they have required some of these facilities to install ambient air monitors at the boundary of the facility. So they have more information to go on to conclude that industrial sand mines are not emitting unsafe levels of PM10.
Now, you said earlier, going back to the getting technical again, the PM2.5, these smaller particles that we're talking about, you said that they have been found to be especially dangerous. Where does that information come from? What is your source for that?
So that comes from the EPA that sets the National Ambient Air Quality Standards for various pollutants, including PM2.5 and PM10. So they set what they believe are safe levels of PM2.5 in the ambient air based on extensive research from many sources.
So given what we've described here, areas where you feel there are holes in the analysis and maybe questions about a bias, what would you like to see happen next?
Well, in short, we'd like to see the DNR be a bit more frank about areas where they don't have enough information to draw conclusions that this industry isn't having impacts to a certain area of natural resources or public health. When we advocate on behalf of citizens, you know, we advocate for our regulatory agencies to follow the precautionary principle. So that is, until we know that a particular industry is entirely safe, we're going to regulate them to prevent potential harms.
We're talking to Sarah Gears right now, staff attorney at Midwest Environmental Advocates, talking about a recent analysis from the DNR, which some have said is too reliant on data from the mining industry itself.
And we want to hear from you. What do you think of Wisconsin's frac sand industry? Do you think it poses health or safety risks? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you work in the mining industry? Tell us what kind of role the industry has had in your life. Do you have a home near any of the mines? Tell us how the industry has impacted your community. Again, that number is 800-642-1234.
We're continuing now with Sarah Gear, staff attorney at Midwest Environmental Advocates, and we're talking about a new analysis of frac sand mining from the DNR, which some environmental groups say relies too much on data that came from the mining industry itself.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How do you view Wisconsin's frac sand industry? What do you want to know about that industry and its impacts? And do you think that the DNR should be doing more independent research on the industry's environmental impact? Again, call 800-642-1234. 1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. And if you live in western Wisconsin or another part of the state where the mines are, tell us how it's affecting your community and maybe your community's health. What about the economic impact? Tell us if you're satisfied with the DNR and the state's regulation of the frac sand industry. Again, that number is 800-642-1234.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Gwen on the line in Weyerhaeuser. Gwen, hi.
Hi, Sarah.
What is your question?
My question is, we live about 2 miles from a drying plant, a silica sand drying plant, and I wondered if Sarah had any information about ambient air quality related to those facilities. We have mounds and mounds of silica sand sitting outside. It's tracked around the community by dump trucks, rail cars. I just wondered about that.
All right. Thank you so much, Gwen. And Gwen describing a lot of, it sounds like exposure, potential exposure anyway, to silica sand in a drying facility. First of all, what is a drying facility?
A drying facility is basically, so it's a later step in the process for handling the sand, getting it ready to be shipped to for whatever use. They first wash the sand to remove material other than the sand of a particular size that they want to harvest. And then that has to go through a drying plant where it's heated and dried to get ready to be shipped.
Okay, and to Gwen's question, do you know what effects you might expect?
Well, you know, that gets to what we've been discussing, which is, you know, our position that the DNR just doesn't have enough information at this point to reliably say that there are not potential negative impacts. Now, that's not meant to scare people like Gwen to think that they're being harmed, but it should be a cause for Gwen and others to advocate to make sure that the DNR's adequately protecting them until they have enough data to show that there aren't negative air impacts.
All right. Thank you, Gwen. Hope that answered part of your question. And we'll go next to Willem and Colfax.
Hi. I live in an area where there are quite a few mines. And when they were putting them in, they were talking about the benefits of the economy and how they were going to create jobs and all that, but they didn't ever mentioned that this is a boom and bust industry. But now that the bust is here, they say, well, oh, this is a boom and bust industry. So during this bust, there's all these huge piles of white refined sand that are blowing in the breeze. Like today, it's very windy, and this stuff blows around. And I'm also work with silica sand, and if you buy a bag of silica sand, it has a warning on it that this is, you know, may cause... it's hazardous and it causes lung cancer and all these other things. So for them to deny it, it's kind of like relying on the tobacco industry's information to do a study about, you know, the health impacts of tobacco. So I don't trust this industry, and I don't think it's been good for our region. It's created a lot of divisiveness amongst neighbors. It harms the tourist industry. It takes trees out of our environment, trees which trap carbon. So there's a lot of negative effects, and the positive effects are lost on me. I don't think it's helped the economy of this region one bit. There's a lot of people who invested their money in buying trucks, and now they were, you know, basically not real employees, but contracted employees. And then when the bust arrived, they got laid off. And
Willem, thank you so much for the call. I appreciate your point of view there. And looking at his questions, are the boom and bust nature of it right now. Oil prices are down, and a lot of these mines are shuttered, maybe for the time being. I guess they may reopen. But do you think, given the boom and bust nature of it, I mean, first of all, has it helped the economy, and is that a good reason to support it? And also, is it getting the scrutiny that you think it deserves at this particular point of time and more of the bust point of it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, he made a lot of good points. You know, one of our concerns as we are going through kind of a downturn in production is that these facilities are being adequately managed while there may not be active processing going on there. So he mentioned the sand piles, and blowing dust from those sand piles can contribute to particulate matter emissions. So DNR, adequate regulation of the facilities that are in in an inactive status is really important. To the question of the economic benefits of this industry, you know, that's been pushed heavily by the industry as a reason to move forward, you know, as quickly as possible to get these facilities built. But as we've seen, that may mean jobs for a short period of time in a community that then leave. And also, you know, because of impacts to our natural resources, it's going to have a negative impact on the very important tourism industry in our state.
Again, thanks for the call. And we're going to go next to Steve in Colfax. Hi, Steve.
Hello. I worked for the in the construction industry for the last 14 years, all over Wisconsin, eastern Minnesota, and I feel that the environmental impacts in the construction industry are far greater than what I've seen working in a sand mine the last year and a half or so. It seems as if the mining contractors have more money in place initially for combating against the environmental impact, especially dust and water impacts. You know, they take go far and above from what I've seen to abide to the ordinances and things in effect with the DNR and county and townships. And I don't think they get enough recognition for the good job that they're doing.
Steve, thank you for that call. And Steve is there, sounds like, on the ground and living near these mines. And he says he thinks these outfits are doing a good job trying to comply.
Yeah, I really appreciate Steve's perspective. You know, we don't hear a lot from the folks who work at these facilities and hear the positive side, like Steve was talking about. You know, I think there certainly are good actors in this industry, like in most, but DNR itself has stated that because of the quick expansion of this industry, they have seen more non-compliance from these facilities than in other industries. You know, additionally, you know, we're certainly not advocating to stop all frac sand mines. What we want is to be sure that all facilities are doing what Steve described, employing good practices to prevent air impacts and surface water impacts.
And Sarah, just briefly, as we wrap up, what is the next move on the table here with this report and with your organization?
Well, the next step is we're trying to get the word out to as many people and organizations as possible so we can get robust public input in this process. There's a public hearing on July 26th at 4 p.m. in Eau Claire, followed by a public comment period where people can submit written comments to DNR through August 22nd. So we'll continue to scrutinize this report and provide technical comments along with our partner organizations, and we encourage citizens to share their stories.
Sarah, thanks so much for coming into the studio and joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Sarah Geer. She's staff attorney at Midwest Environmental Advocates. She was talking with us there about a recent report on the frac sand industry from the DNR.